SBS live streams and podcasts are supported by advertising.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
Vous êtes avec SBS French.
Nous rendons hommage aux propriétaires traditionnels de la terre à partir de laquelle SBS French diffuse. Le peuple Wurundjeri de la nation Kulin ainsi que leurs aînés passés et présents. Nous rendons hommage également à toutes les tribus et clans aborigènes ainsi que les insulaires du détroit Torres auxquels nous diffusons.
SBS, a world of difference. You're with SBS French, on mobile, online and on radio.
Vous êtes avec SBS French sur votre smartphone, en ligne et à la radio.
Mesdames et messieurs, bonjour et bienvenue sur SBS French. Bertrand Tunganamé pour vous accompagner ce samedi 24 août. Au menu de cette édition, découverte de SBS Examines, une nouvelle série de reportages sur SBS destinée à combattre la désinformation. Ce samedi, nous allons découvrir ensemble la définition d'un mot chargé d'émotions, un mot souvent galvaudé, un mot aussi chargé de bagages historiques. Il s'agit du mot « génocide ». Et sur une note plus légère, pour vous mettre de l'eau à la bouche ce samedi, on va vous parler d'une masterclass sur la meilleure façon d'apprécier trois délices, le fromage, le chocolat et le mousseux. Mais comme tous les samedis, dans Rétrospective, on revient sur un fait historique. Cette semaine, Valentine Saburo, au micro de Jean-Noël Ducasse, revient sur le moment historique où la France a rejoint le cercle restreint de puissance nucléaire.
Radio SBS en français, en ligne et sur votre smartphone.
Et voici l'heure de notre rétrospective. Aujourd'hui, Valentine Saburo nous raconte le largage historique de la première bombe française dans le Pacifique, un succès militaire aux conséquences humaines et environnementales qui se font sentir encore aujourd'hui. Récit avec les archives de l'Institut national de l'audiovisuel.
C'est l'histoire, selon les mots du général de Gaulle, d'un magnifique succès pour l'indépendance et la sécurité de la France. Nous sommes le 24 août 1968 et l'Hexagone vient de larguer sa première bombe à hydrogène dans l'océan Pacifique, rejoignant ainsi le cercle très fermé des grandes puissances nucléaires d'alors, à savoir les États-Unis, l'URSS, le Royaume-Uni et la Chine. À la fin de la Seconde Guerre mondiale, le général de Gaulle crée le CEA, Commissariat à l'énergie atomique, pour développer l'application de l'atome dans les sciences, l'industrie et la défense. On n'en est pas encore à mettre en place une force de dissuasion, mais ça ne va pas tarder. La guerre froide, puis la débâcle indo-chinoise, vont pousser la France à changer de braquet. Elle va se lancer dans un programme nucléaire militaire dès 1954 de façon officieuse, en 1958 de façon officielle. 13 février 1960, elle teste sa première bombe A dans le Grand Sud algérien. C'est l'opération Gerboise bleue à laquelle succéderont Gerboise rouge puis Gerboise verte. Les essais deviennent ensuite souterrains avant d'être relocalisés dans le Pacifique sur l'atoll de Mururoa. En 1966, le général de Gaulle en déplacement en Polynésie réaffirme ainsi les raisons de la stratégie française.
Une puissance moderne, non pas une puissance destinée à attaquer ou à dominer personne, au contraire. Une force qui, dans le monde très dangereux où nous nous trouvons, doit nous donner la capacité de dissuader les autres de nous attaquer.
Le 24 août 1968, c'est le grand jour. L'atoll qui a eu l'extrême honneur d'être choisi pour un essai crucial s'appelle Fongataufa. C'est un coin de paradis inhabité sur lequel on a construit quelques bâtiments et une piste d'aviation. L'opération baptisée Canopus est simple Explication du journal télévisé de l'époque.
C'est suspendu à ce pacifique ballon captif gonflé à l'hydrogène qu'a explosé au-dessus du lagon de l'atoll de Fangatofa, Canopus, la première bombe H expérimentale française. Scénario désormais classique, observé depuis le croiseur de Grasse à 70 km du lieu de l'explosion. Une immense lueur dégageant autant d'énergie que 2 millions de tonnes de TNT, et puis l'énorme champignon qui est, selon les techniciens, parfaitement inoffensif.
Serge Lecordier, jeune marin envoyé à bord de la Tarentule, témoignera de ce qu'il a vu quelques heures après seulement. À bâbord, nous regardons effrayé l'immense tour de télécommunication quasiment plié en deux. Le lagon est tout blanc. Il est jonché de milliers de cadavres de poissons. La Terre, c'est un spectacle d'apocalypse. Il n'y a plus un cocotier debout et il y a des feux à leur base. Des nuages de mouches sont déjà sur les cadavres avec cette âcre odeur de brûlé. Selon les analyses d'un médecin, la nourriture n'a pourtant pas été affectée par le largage. Les mesures de sécurité sont donc réduites au minimum. Pour la préparation d'un deuxième essai, de jeunes militaires sont d'ailleurs envoyés pour déblayer immédiatement le terrain, sans protection particulière et avec des tentes pour se labrer. Les compteurs gégèrent s'affolent, une grève est même envisagée, mais l'idée est vite abandonnée. Au total, 193 essais nucléaires aériens et souterrains seront conduits en Polynésie sans conséquences écologiques, selon Jacques Chirac qui y mettra toutefois un terme en 1996. En 2010, un pas est fait avec la loi Morin.
Ce texte est un texte qui, à la fois, permet à la France de tirer définitivement un trait sur cette période de son histoire, de reconnaître les souffrances des personnes victimes de ces retombées radioactives et qui ont pu ensuite développer une maladie, et enfin, d'ouvrir une page nouvelle.
Des dizaines de milliers de militaires, travailleurs et civils présentant des pathologies radio-induites comme le cancer de la thyroïde ou la leucémie sont concernés. Beaucoup se feront connaître, mais peu obtiendront le précieux statut ouvrant la voie aux indemnisations. En 2023, un peu moins de 835 millions ont été versés à 64 victimes ou ayants droit polynésiens. Trop peu, selon les associations.
Vous écoutez le français sur Radio SPS.
Nous marquons une pause en musique avec Walter Astral qui nous interprète La Lune. Mais restez à l'écoute. Après la pause, un reportage de RFI sur l'ouverture du village paralympique à Paris.
Vous êtes passionné de films ? SBS On Demand a des centaines de films disponibles, visionnables à n'importe quel moment. Pour le meilleur des films dramatiques, des documentaires, des films d'horreur, des comédies et des films d'amour, allez sur sbs.com.au/on-demand.
Bientôt, vous verrez peut-être moins d'actualité dans vos fils d'actualité sur les réseaux sociaux en Australie. C'est donc le moment de télécharger l'application SPS Audio. Assurez-vous de recevoir toutes nos informations, points de vue et histoires dans notre podcast SPS Language pour rester connecté aux sujets qui vous tiennent à cœur. L'application SPS Audio est gratuite sur l'App Store et Google Play.
Avant le lancement des Jeux paralympiques de Paris, le village de Saint-Denis a rouvert ses portes ce mercredi au nord de la capitale. 9000 résidents sont attendus et il a fallu, Pierre-Olivier, quelques ajustements depuis les Jeux olympiques.
Pour accueillir les para-athlètes et leurs équipes, le village olympique a d'abord été entièrement nettoyé. L'occasion aussi de procéder à quelques mises à jour pour faciliter la vie des sportifs en situation de handicap. Bien sûr, le site est équipé d'ascenseurs depuis sa création, mais pour fluidifier au maximum les déplacements, notamment des personnes en fauteuil roulant, les trottoirs du village ont été abaissés au niveau de la chaussée. Autre modification, les panneaux de signalisation sont de couleurs très contrastées pour permettre aux malvoyants de s'orienter plus facilement. Dans les chambres des para-athlètes, l'ensemble du mobilier est sur roulettes pour pouvoir être déplacé. Et dans les salles de bain, des assises ont été rajoutées dans les douches afin que les personnes à mobilité réduite puissent s'asseoir pendant qu'elles font leur toilette. Enfin, le plus grand aménagement depuis les JO concerne la salle de réparation du matériel des para-athlètes. Fauteuils roulants, prothèses, matériel sportif, c'est dans cette véritable usine au sein du village paralympique que s'affaireront 160 techniciens pour assurer aux sportifs une qualité d'équipement toujours optimale.
Pierre-Olivier, et la billetterie de ces Jeux paralympiques, elle se porte plutôt très bien. Plus d'1 750 000 places se sont déjà vendues pour les épreuves qui débuteront le 29 août. Les organisateurs s'en félicitent et ils comptent bien surfer sur le succès populaire des Jeux olympiques pour attirer les foules lors de ces Jeux paralympiques. Baptiste Coulon.
1 750 000 billets vendus, dont 700 000 depuis la cérémonie d'ouverture sur la scène. Pour les organisateurs, le signal est clair, il y a bien un élan olympique sur les Jeux paralympiques. Succès à nuancer, car loin de l'objectif de départ, 2,8 millions de billets, ramenés finalement à 2,5 officiellement en raison de contraintes techniques. Notons aussi qu'un tiers des billets ont été vendus à l'État et aux collectivités qui les redistribuent au public prioritaire. L'escrime fauteuil au Grand Palais, le cécifoot au pied de la Tour Eiffel, le tir à l'arc aux Invalides, ces disciplines dans des lieux toujours emblématiques de Paris affichent les meilleurs taux de remplissage, 75 voire 90%. Mais le profil des acheteurs diffère des Jeux Olympiques. Des acheteurs français dans 9 cas sur 10 et majoritairement de régions parisiennes. Reste que cette billetterie demeure attractive, avec des places à partir de 15 euros pour certaines épreuves. Et pas question de baisser davantage le prix si elle ne s'écoule pas. Les organisateurs parisiens sur un effet paralympique dès que les épreuves auront débuté.
Baptiste Coulon. Et la cérémonie d'ouverture se tiendra à Place de la Concorde et sur les Champs-Élysées. Cérémonie, encore une fois, donc en dehors d'un stade. Et une fois de plus, c'est Thomas Joly qui est aux manettes à la direction artistique, lui qui avait déjà imaginé l'ouverture des Jeux Olympiques sur la scène. Les organisateurs promettent une cérémonie paralympique, je cite, inclusive et spectaculaire. Événement à suivre donc mercredi prochain, ce sera à 18h, temps universel.
C'était le nougat, un morceau du duo réunionnais Bonbon Vaudou. Nous avons marqué une pause, puis Léo Roussel nous propose aujourd'hui la définition exacte d'un terme souvent galvaudé dans la presse et dans le langage courant. C'est un terme chargé d'émotion, d'un bagage historique. Cette définition est proposée dans une nouvelle série de SBS Examines. Il s'agit du mot « génocide ».
I'm sharing the thrill of walking across this vast country with some friends.
Julia's joined by Gina Chick.
I'm absolutely loving the bird's eye view.
And Susie Youssef.
This place is so beautiful.
For more great walks across more of Australia.
And I really get a sense that I'm on top of the world.
There's no one here. Just how I like it.
Great Australian Walks. Stream free on SBS On Demand.
Assurez-vous d'obtenir une vue d'ensemble complète, pas seulement ce que votre fil d'actualité sur les réseaux sociaux vous offre. Retrouvez toutes nos actualités et histoires sur le site SBS Language. Enregistrez notre site sbs.com.au/language dans les favoris de votre navigateur dès aujourd'hui.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.
Votre communauté, vos conversations. SBS French.
Bienvenue sur SBS French. Aujourd'hui, nous vous proposons un nouvel épisode de SBS Examines. SBS Examines est un podcast de SBS qui vise à lutter contre les fausses informations et la désinformation, ainsi que leur impact sur la cohésion sociale. Dans cet épisode, nous allons parler du crime de génocide. C'est un terme fort, alors que signifie-t-il vraiment et qui décide de qualifier un conflit de génocide ? Un podcast écrit par Olivia Diorio, traduit et présenté en français par Léo Roussel.
I'm interested in genocide because it happened so many times. It happened to the Armenians and after the Armenians, Hitler took action.
Lui, c'est Raphaël Lemkin, l'homme qui se cache derrière l'origine du mot génocide. C'est cet avocat polonais qui a créé ce terme en 1944. Le mot « génocide » tire son origine du préfixe grec « génos » qui signifie « la race » et du suffixe latin « cide » qui veut dire « tuer ». La création de ce terme par Raphaël Lemkin survient en partie en réponse à l'Holocauste, mais aussi à de précédents événements historiques.
And he thought, how is it that one person can be prosecuted and convicted and punished for killing one person, but we don't have the same crime for someone killing hundreds or thousands or even millions of people.
Pour la docteure Melanie O'Brien, présidente de l'ONG International Association of Genocide Scholars, c'est grâce au travail de Lemkin que le génocide a été reconnu comme un crime international en 1948, sous ce que l'on connaît aujourd'hui comme la Convention pour la prévention et la répression du crime de génocide.
Genocide is a set of crimes, a listed set of crimes that are committed with the intent to destroy in whole or in part a national, racial, ethnic or religious group. And the particular crimes of genocide include the crime of killing, crimes of causing serious bodily or mental harm, the crimes of transferring children from one group to another, and several other crimes are listed as well.
Seuls les pays qui ont ratifié le traité sont obligés de l'appliquer, et sur les 195 pays reconnus dans le monde, 153 l'ont signé.
Now those state parties have made a promise, essentially they are bound under the convention, to prevent and punish the crime of genocide.
Mais concrètement, quelles sont les conséquences en cas de non-respect de cette convention?
That accountability might be in a criminal court, or it might be in the International Court of Justice, which is a court that adjudicates disputes between states. And that includes disputes over treaties, including the Genocide Convention.
Présenté comme ça, le processus a l'air simple. Poursuivre des États ou des individus devant un tribunal, présenter des preuves qui peuvent conduire à la reconnaissance légale d'un crime de génocide. Les décisions de la justice peuvent alors inclure des réparations, la promesse de ne jamais reproduire ces violences et même la facilitation du retour des populations qui ont été déplacées. En tout, il existe des centaines d'événements et de circonstances qui peuvent tomber sous la définition du génocide. Mais pour Sarah Williams, professeure en droit international à l'Université de Nouvelle-Galles du Sud, seule une poignée d'entre eux ont, dans les faits, été reconnus comme tels devant la justice.
The genocide is notoriously difficult to prove. So that's why you might see prosecutors choosing to go for other crimes.
Devant la Cour internationale de justice de La Haye, seuls 4 cas ont relevé de la non-application de la Convention pour la prévention et la répression du crime de génocide. Et c'est en grande partie parce que seul un pays peut déposer une plainte.
And so what we've seen is a great reluctance. Obviously a state's not going to bring a claim against itself. So we've been relying on other states effectively reporting states committing genocide to the International Court of Justice, and for very many reasons, most obviously political, states haven't wanted to do that.
En septembre 2023, 32 pays, dont la France et l'Australie, ont soutenu l'Ukraine après sa plainte déposée contre la Russie, affirmant qu'un génocide mené par la Russie était en cours en Ukraine. Mais l'issue de ce cas pourrait encore prendre de nombreuses années, ce qui, pour la professeure Sarah Williams, montre une autre faille du système, sa lenteur.
It's partly because of the different procedural steps. So you're talking probably 7 to 10 years potentially from the time something is commenced to the time you get a fully reasoned judgment. So it doesn't move particularly quickly.
Dans le même temps, la Cour internationale de justice peut réclamer des mesures provisoires.
So effectively interim orders that would try and bring an end here to the genocide.
Mais qu'en est-il dans le cas d'individus? Comment quelqu'un peut-il être tenu pour responsable d'un génocide?
The ICC looks at individual criminal responsibility, so they're looking at things to the standard of beyond reasonable doubt, in the same way a court would look at a murder charge in Australia, for example.
En 22 ans d'existence, la Cour pénale internationale n'a délivré qu'un seul mandat d'arrêt pour génocide. C'était en 2009, à l'encontre d'Omar Hassan Ahmad al-Bashir, le président du Soudan, pour le génocide au Darfour. 15 ans plus tard, il n'a toujours pas été arrêté pour être présenté devant la Cour pénale internationale. De nombreux facteurs politiques et juridiques doivent être pris en compte pour prouver l'existence d'un génocide. Mais le terme est utilisé en permanence et pas uniquement dans le contexte du droit international.
The word has an emotional attachment to it in a way other crimes don't. And I think that's this idea that it's a hierarchy, it's this crime of crimes. I think there are different definitions.
Professeur de droit international et de mise en pratique des droits humains à l'Université de New York, Vasuki Nessia explique que le terme génocide est aussi utilisé comme outil de protestation ou pour témoigner une immense peine.
It's often treated as if it should be something that's decided by courts or that the convention is the only reference point for a genocide, but in fact, you know, people had, you know, across the world, many different kinds of ways of talking about the kinds of mass atrocity that we now use genocide as sort of a singular term to describe.
Vasuki Nessia affirme que le mot génocide est un terme puissant, en partie parce qu'il est reconnu et facilement utilisable à travers le monde.
It becomes a way to translate different experiences of grave abuse into a language that is now a way of talking about it in different parts of the world.
La professeure ajoute que le mot génocide a été débattu depuis sa reconnaissance comme crime international en 1948, mais que celui-ci ne doit pas pour autant être réduit à des définitions légales strictes.
Vous écoutez Le Français sur Radio SBS.
C'était Emeraude, une chanson de Phil avec Opinard et Compromis. Après la pause, comment apprécier trois délices, le fromage, le chocolat et le mousseux.
SBS Food a tous les ingrédients pour votre prochain repas. Vous y trouverez des milliers de recettes issues des cuisines du monde. Essayez les petits plats des experts de SBS Food. Et regardez comment ils les réalisent pas à pas. sbs.com.au/food.
I'm joined by Josephine Donnell of Milk Chocolates and Valerie Ambest of Smelly Cheese Co. to talk about their inaugural cheese and chocolate masterclass in Melbourne and give us some insights into how to pair chocolate and cheese. Valerie and Josephine, first of all, thanks for joining us and welcome to SBS French.
Thank you. We're so glad to be with you today.
Thank you, Bertrand. It's lovely to be here.
Let's just start by talking about your respective specialties and how you blend them and bring them together in such an unusual way, an unusual pairing. Let's start with you, Valerie. Maybe tell us about your journey with the Smelly Cheese Company.
Yes.
And then we'll move on to Josephine, how you met and how you come with this idea of pairing these unusual flavors.
Thank you, Bertrand. Well, it's a journey that started a long time ago for me, really discovering my love for cheese. I left France in the late 90s, following the love of my life. And when I arrived there, I loved everything except maybe the cheese range, which was, in my view, a little limited. So I started out of necessity. And what it brought to me is suddenly the being in contact with passionate people that were doing something with an incredible commitment to quality and to... I suddenly thought it was very important not only to bring cheese that I really needed in Australia for my own consumption and then share that love, but share also the story behind every cheese I was bringing. I'm since working with Australian cheesemakers as well, and really with a deeper understanding of the sense of place and what the origin in a product like cheese, how important that is. And the more people understand that, I think the better their consumption experience. So if you, it's really sharing this understanding with people so that they enjoy the product even more. As for Josephine, we met because I love chocolate as well. Who doesn't? And I discovered a few years ago that cheese and chocolate was a great combination, and it's just simply the idea of bringing salt and sugar, bringing cream and crunchy. It's just playing with people's brain and polarizing it one way and then the other. It's again with this idea of making an experience bigger. Josephine was an obvious candidate to explore that idea because she's possibly as crazy as I am, as I discovered lately.
Yeah, you're all very creative, and I just heard her explain, her specialty, the chocolates, the origins, even some origins I never even thought about myself, like, well, of course, Madagascar, but I never knew that their kind of chocolate was one of the finest ones. So, Josephine, tell us about your journey and also how you came to blend your special sweet flavors with the savory flavors that Valerie brings to the table.
Absolutely.
It's not just a combination. It's a marriage between two very different flavors, and, taste buds are completely blown out with this combination.
Absolutely. I think chocolate for me has always been an obsession, and it's brought me from Sweden all the way to Australia. Discovering chocolate was something I did as a child, and as a grown-up, I believe that chocolate is what I will think about and dream about and breathe for the rest of my life. Flavors are just intriguing for me. I've always looked for the flavors in the origin of chocolate, so looking for the inherent flavors that come from the cacao bean and trying to bring out, it's my job to bring out as much as possible of that inherent flavor and the many complexities of cacao. Always trying to find the balance with that, as well as bringing out the creative ideas that I dream about to try and make it into something new that's never been explored before, or maybe many people haven't tasted before. That's always the excitement for me, and I love the look on people's faces when they taste something for the first time. So bringing together Valerie and myself was just an exciting opportunity for this tasting event where, for the first time I'm getting challenged by cheese flavors, and that puts things into a new perspective for me. That was really, really great, and we had a good amount of time to think about how we could perform that best, and some of those flavors that we did last night were just spectacular, I thought. They worked so well, and I loved the most that most people that arrived and participated hadn't tried this combination before. They hadn't tried chocolate and cheese before, and they walked out, I think, different people, maybe. Hope so.
Can you describe some specific cheese and chocolate pairings that work particularly well, and how did you find that they really combine very well? They come together, they really perfect matches.
I think my perfect pairing from last night was definitely the Fond d'Ambert with the cacao nougatine and yuzu peel. I think blue cheese for me begs for dark chocolate, and it was just an extraordinary match. There's sort of the sweetness and the fruit of the cacao, the nougatine, just works so beautifully with all the complex flavors of that blue cheese. It really pops, and especially when you bring something like cacao nibs into it, you have more burst of flavor as you break down this little nougatine in your mouth. So that was my favorite pairing of the night, and one that I was most excited about seeing people experience. Blue cheese and chocolate, definitely a very very natural pairing for me. But also we had some extraordinary soft brie cheeses with Madagascan pepper and Madagascan cacao, which is one of my favorite origins of cacao, and my favorite milk chocolate. So milk chocolate and cheese may not be the most usual pairing. They usually go dark or, you know, sweeter dark chocolate, but milk chocolate, the creaminess of that and the clean flavors of fruity Madagascan cacao just works.
For me personally, it was a great discovery because some pairings, I tasted some cheese. The taste was a little bit mild, and then when you combine with a particular chocolate, it just bursts with the other flavors. It becomes more salty, or a little bit of sourness coming in, a little bit of, you know, different feels and tastes, and it's just amazing. Especially the very first combination that we tried was a very mild, soft, creamy cheese. But as soon as you mix it, the mildness goes away and the salt just pops out suddenly, and it's really intriguing.
It was also one of my favorites because it's really fantastically representative of what's happening, what you can make happen in somebody's brain, where you have something extraordinarily creamy, decadent. It sort of really completely fill up the mouth. It's a mouth feel, and then you bring an element, you bring texture, and it suddenly pops in your mouth as you described so well, and it's really going. It's sort of get their brain even, you know, bigger and wide open. It wakes people up. If you have the same texture in your mouth, you would be forgiven to fall asleep. You need little, you know, reminder that, hey, something is happening. Stay awake. Stay with us. And then you take them from salty characteristic and you add the spice aspect into it. And then you finish with a lingering toasted caramel notes. And it's a journey that's really... It takes a long time to die if you pay attention.
And one of the most exciting thing about this masterclass, it was my very first one, I have to admit it, really impressed by the organization that you put in, but it's also a very fun atmosphere, very friendly, and a very nice way of actually spending an evening after a day's work. You just walk in and bunch of people were there just to enjoy a good time, which was exceptional. How did you come up with this concept?
I really have done that for a very long time, and I just love it as much as you do. And I think that's the secret. I'm having fun with you. I just really love sharing what I'm passionate about. And I reached a stage in my life where I'm not holding back too much, and I feel like I need to provoke people a little bit. And what's important, I think, is to allow people to go back to their enthusiastic self, to go back to the time where they were little people, where they could be extraordinarily happy and excited. It's good to see, you know, when they first come in and they feel like a little reserved, they hardly look at you and there's a little shyness there. But very quickly, when you allow them to tap into their little sneaky younger version of themselves, they usually play the game quite nicely, and it sort of breaks the ice, and people are happy to use your fingers and touch the cheese and touch the chocolate and do silly things like with the triple cream. We tell them that it's good for your skin, so lots of people suddenly were wiping the triple cream on their hands and see the extraordinary fabulous moisturizer it can become. I mean, and then licking their hand. We're just creating new trends here in Melbourne. If you see people licking their hands, you know what they've been doing last night.
Cheese can be a good moisturizer. That's one thing that I also discovered that night. And discovered, of course, this unusual pairing. Now, for the lay person, because you two are professionals, you come from very fine chocolate, very extensive range of cheeses, and really great experience in preparing and presenting your products. But for the lay person at home, are there any particular techniques or tips for presenting and serving cheese with chocolate to actually maximize the tasting experience?
Well, from the chocolate perspective, I would say the more the merrier. I think you should not be afraid of adding it onto your cheese board. You should not be afraid to try the different combinations. And that's something that, you know, Valerie spoke loudly about yesterday as well. You should not be afraid to try things for the first time and see how it works. The first thing I did when I came back from our event last night is I tried all the cheeses again with the chocolates again. You wouldn't think that that's possible after last night, but I did. And I tried some of the combinations with the other cheeses that we didn't do last night. And I thought it was fascinating to see how they play together. And I think that is the key. You've got to be playful. You've got to try it for the first time. You do it with someone that you enjoy trying things with. And I think that is the most exciting moment when you discover how different something can taste together with someone, with the right wine, with the wrong wine, on a board, out in the open, or in a comfortable setting. I think last night in a great small intimate room together with some of the best people, the most excited people of Melbourne, that was a great way of discovering those flavors. I think
you just mentioned something that we didn't really talk about at the very beginning of this conversation. It was a pairing of cheese and chocolate, but it was also an evening where sparkling was presented at its finest and best. Tell us about the role of the particular sparkling that you had and how it
helped. Yeah, so we selected that sparkling a long time ago. We work a lot with this particular winemaker. It's Howard's Vineyard in the Adelaide Hills. Everything this particular winemaker does is really fresh, crisp, have the perfect line of acidity. And when you want to pair cheese, especially but chocolate as well, with wine or sparkling, you absolutely require a beautiful line of acidity. You want a wine that can really go through the fat contents of both the cheese and the chocolate, and also lift up the fat and just allow your palate to go back to neutral position while still having your taste buds dancing. I think sparkling has that potential to get your taste buds like in a dancing mode. And this one was so elegant as well. It's Chardonnay, Pinot Noir together. So it's the color is slightly rose, petal rose. It's just very attractive to the eye. And then it's slightly floral and fruity without being too overwhelming. It's quite dry. So it does a fabulous job to not only cleanse your palate, but also put you in a fantastic mood, I think. It was a great Howard's Vineyard Chardonnay Pinot Noir. Delicious, yeah.
Great pairing. I could have stayed all night.
But if I may say so, when you ask the question about, how to make a cheese board, it's interesting because Josephine says the more the merrier. In terms of the cheese, I usually say less is more because, those big boards where there's so many things and you lose track with what's what and what should go with what. So I feel like if you stick to 2, 3, 4 cheeses, then you know exactly what you have. You play with color, shape, texture. So usually 3 is a good one. You get a soft one, then a hard one, then maybe a blue, and then you have different colors, different texture, different shape. And I think, the visual of it is quite important. Plus, then, of course, the flavor profile. So you've got something very creamy, something quite hard, something quite spicy. So you play with all that. It's really, I agree with you, Josephine. It has to be playful, enjoyable, and don't be scared to experiment, for sure.
You mentioned that the cheeses that we consume here, a particular cheese, gets some more than the penicillium coming from France. All the flavors we get to enjoy here actually have got a little bit of a French origin to them. Tell us a little bit more about that.
Oh, yeah, that's quite interesting and fascinating, and not a lot of people know that. But blue cheese has its origin in Roquefort-sur-le-Soulzon. Anyway, in Auvergne region, which used to be an old volcano and that created caves, inherently in that caves, there is a little bacteria that lives there. A long time ago, cheeses were a pure result of the terroir they were coming from. Like Washrein, the bacteria was living in Burgundy. In Auvergne, you have the penicillium Roqueforti that we now understand. And the people there put rye bread in that cave, because they know that in 3 weeks, this bread is going to be covered in that blue mold. This blue mold is then turned into a liquid form or powder form and used to make all the blue cheese in France. But interestingly for Australia, this Penicillium Roqueforti is sent over to Australia, and every single blue cheese here in Australia are made with that Penicillium Roqueforti. So in essence, we are all linked to that little Auvergne region. There is every blue cheese here, if you listen to it carefully, they all have a little French accent.
So Jesus can speak, and you both presented something that, and you said something really, you'd say, provocative to everyone. You said cheese crackers are just passé, forget about them.
Well, absolutely. You know, I'm French. Well, crackers. Did you have crackers when you grew up, Bertrand?
I'm used to them. I had a lot of cheese back in Belgium. Actually, you said France has a lot of cheeses. And in Belgium, actually, the country has a lot of cheeses, including some very fine cheese made by Trappist monks. I don't recall having cheese with crackers, but in Australia, you can't have cheese without crackers.
It's interesting because crackers is not part of a cheese board in France. At best, you have a bit of bread, so you've got fresh baguettes or sometimes, you know, whole grain bread. And, you know, when with the blue, you can have a bread with walnut and raisin, something that's really lift up the...
Yeah.
But crackers, no. And I think it was... We really wanted to do something different, and... when you have chocolate, the pure idea is really using the chocolate as your cracker. So it's really pushes you to get those two together. Chocolate is a bit more sturdy than the cheese, and it plays perfectly the role of a cracker, and it adds this little je ne sais quoi, which is quite exciting, I think.
Yeah. And your own chocolate range, which one works the best with which cheese?
I would say, speaking of yesterday, I think...
Some of the chocolate actually was just fine by itself. For a sweet tooth, you can just enjoy it without anything. But when you pair it with cheese, it's a whole different experience. But with chocolate...
Absolutely. I think any of our so dark origins with a little bit of acidity or fruity flavor, I really enjoy that, in particular with some of the creamier cheeses with a little bit of higher salt. I tend to choose cacao origins that have a bit of acidity. It's what I enjoy to eat in chocolate. Some people choose more nutty or rounder, so more body in the cacao beans, to look for that in their chocolate. I do enjoy when there's a bit of fruit in there. It just reminds me of the cacao pod, and I think it plays really well with cheese because of it. Because I always expect a bit of fruit on a cheese board, whether that is dried fruit, whether it is a beautiful fresh pear. That I enjoy more than cheese crackers. I would definitely agree, crackers are it's superfluous.
And now I know I've caught you on short notice, and I know you have many more commitments. Where to from now? More masterclasses? You're going to other cities? What's in for our audience? Because we're not only broadcasting from Melbourne. Naam is the indigenous name for Melbourne, but are you spreading this idea across Australia? Where are you taking this place?
Well, the world is our limit here, we definitely, Josephine and I, are going to do that again for sure. One date is brewing right now. I think early December you'll hear from us. We'll be here back with different cheese, different chocolate. Watch out, she's crazy when it comes to creation. As for myself, I'm going to Paris in September to do my first cheese and wine masterclass at the top of Le Printemps du Goût. So having a little champagne overlooking the Eiffel Tower, l'Opéra and the Madeleine, I'll quite look forward for that. And we tour Australia. We'll be in Brisbane in October as well. We're really going everywhere. We've been to Perth. We were in Perth. We were in Tasmania. So wherever we can and wherever we see an opportunity, we're very happy to present that. But I think sharing that idea is going to make people more looking out for this type of experiences, and that's a great idea to spread the love there. So thank you, Bertrand.
You're welcome. And Monique, any future projects you want to share with us?
I would just like to, you know, say that I think Melbourne is a great city to come to for, you know, for experience of, with chocolate. Of course, my next destination will be Adelaide and exploring Say Cheese in Adelaide Market. I've longed for it. I haven't been there for a while. That'll be my next destination. But we will be doing many more events at our Looking Glass event space up in Centre Place in the Melbourne CBD.
And can I also add that I created late last year a podcast based on all the senses. It's called Sensing Up. I interviewed Josephine yesterday, so it's going to be aired very soon. But if you like the idea of hearing from people who have this, who share the passion of food and this appreciation and help everyone to have a greater experience, well, Sensing Up is there for that. I've been interviewing people in France, in Switzerland, in Italy. So it's a big array of good slices of fabulous flavors.
Excellent. Very creative. So you're into podcasting, a little bit of competition for us. Cheese making and chocolate, really a very, very great combination. I can't really commend this more. Josephine and Valerie, thank you very much for taking the time to join us on SBS French today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much, Bertrand.
Radio SBS, les informations, les actualités et les histoires qui vous inspirent dans votre langue. Joignez-vous à la conversation. sbs.com.au/French.
Plus en l'air, j'ai tout froid, je manque d'air. Hashtag tu me manques, hashtag tu me manques.
Avec cette chanson Tu me manques de Sana Manote, nous touchons à la fin de cette édition. Merci de nous avoir suivis. Je vous donne rendez-vous demain à la même heure. Bon après-midi et à demain.
Partagez, commentez. Suivez-nous sur facebook.com/sbsfrench.
SBS is Australia's most trusted multilingual broadcaster. Our listeners are loyal, highly engaged, and have supported countless local businesses. We offer advertising packages for businesses of all sizes. Our experienced sales team will guide you through the process of owning a great campaign. Bring your own ad or have our production team make you something in one of our 68 languages. Start the conversation with your new audience today. Email sales@sbs.com.au.